After a lot of anticipation, Facebook goes public this week, and its future depends largely on one question. Do Facebook ads work? Potential investors are betting that Facebook will become an advertising behemoth. But surprisingly, there's very little public research to back them up. What's out there is mostly anecdotal. For instance, General Motors yesterday pulled its ads from Facebook, saying they didn't generate more sales. So NPR Steve Henn and Zoe Chase from our Planet Money team decided they would run their own little test.
First, we need our guinea pig, a business in need of Facebook advertising.
I found it at Jazz Fest. Michael Friedman and Greg Augarten sell New York-style pizza at a takeout window that could only be found in New Orleans, between the streets of piety and desire.
Can you make good New York pizza outside of New York? And the dough is like the most important thing.
It's called Pizza Delicious. Two nights a week, if you're in the know, you call them up and order a pie. Business has been good, but they're about to buy their own place. So for the first time, they're thinking about paid advertising.
I also wonder if people would think us advertising would be lame. I don't know. People think we're like really cool because we're like a pop-up restaurant, but so much of what we've done is just out of necessity.
For the new spot, the restaurant, they're going to need a solid stream of customers. They've been thinking about advertising on Facebook, but didn't know how.
So we hooked them up with a social media ad guru in California.
I got the pizza guys into a studio in New Orleans.
I got Rob Leathern, CEO of Optimal, into a studio in San Francisco.
And San Francisco. Rob, can you hear everybody too?
Yep, I can hear everyone real well.
What's up, Rob?
What's up?
While these guys wanted to sell more pizza, we had an ulterior motive.
We wanted to get inside an ad campaign on Facebook and see if it really worked. Would buying an ad on Facebook actually help sell more pizzas?
First, they had to build an ad.
Facebook's story is if your friends like something, you're more likely to try it. So the guys decided to target the friends of people who liked Pizza Delicious.
74% of people in New Orleans are already friends with someone who is a fan of your page.
224,000 people.
Facebook can slice up potential customers in New Orleans 1,000 different ways.
They were looking for people jonesing for real New York pizza.
Type in like the New York Knicks or something. So you can add like the New York Jets, Carmelo Anthony, the Giants.
Making the New York connection cut the reach of the ad down to 15,000. And how could this not work?
We had nailed the demographic. They were golden.
But 12 hours later, we started getting these calls from Michael.
On his cell phone. They were kind of sad.
Yeah, it was like all zeros across the board.
Facebook doesn't make money till people click on the ad. If no one clicks, they turn the ad off.
They'd struck out. They had just 48 hours to make this work.
So they changed the target. They dropped the Knicks fans.
We just put in pizza for New Orleans.
And then, Zoe, you had this stroke of genius.
Stop. You could add, like, these other things that came up, like Italian and mozzarella and gnocchi and espresso.
Yeah, and people like ice cream, generally like pizza, that helps out. We're up to, like, 30,000.
The ads went viral, as they say, twice the usual number of click-throughs. The ad showed up more than 700,000 times. Basically, everyone in New Orleans on Facebook saw it. Twice. And Pizza Delicious got close to 20 times the number of Facebook fans they usually get in 2 days.
Is that feeling of exhilaration worth $240? I don't know. But hopefully it adds some more business.
The pizza guys paid close to a dollar for each new fan. And while those fans checked out their page on Facebook and clicked like, this was no guarantee they were going to show up and actually buy some pizza.
Cut to last Thursday night, 48 hours after the ad started running. More than 200 new fans later. Here's Greg.
After a long night of asking every single customer where they found out about Pizza Delicious, none of them said that they found out about us through the Facebook ad. Zero people.
But while Greg took the garbage out, he checked his phone, and there was a message.
Just found out about you guys via a sponsored Facebook ad, if you can believe it. Super excited about your new place. Happy to toss in a few bones over the top.
And this guy kicked in $10 to support the new restaurant.
Yeah, and that was cool. I thought that was really cool of him. And we got some return on our ad that we could actually see.
Right, let's be clear. You made $10 off a $240 investment.
We did.
Maybe someday these guys' new fans will show up and buy some pizza. But social advertising's so new, nobody knows for sure. It's still unproven, untested, largely unstudied.
There's just not a huge body of research out there about the conversion from Facebook fans to buyers. Some companies like Ben & Jerry's say they've gotten a big return.
but it's anecdotal.
Advertisers on Facebook are betting they can make it work, that the customers will come.
And that's what Facebook's investors are betting on, too. I'm Steve Henn in Silicon Valley.
Zoe Chace, NPR News, New York.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. A big new study has found that drinking coffee appears to reduce the risk of dying prematurely. As NPR's Rob Stein reports, the study from the New England Journal of Medicine doesn't prove coffee will help you live longer, but it suggests it won't hurt you either.
There's been lots of research into whether coffee's good or bad for people's health. But Neil Friedman of the National Institutes of Health says there's been a big problem.
The results have really been mixed. There's been some evidence that coffee might increase the risk of certain diseases, and there's been also more maybe recently accumulating evidence that coffee might protect against other diseases as well.
So Friedman and his colleagues analyzed data from more than 400,000 people. It's the largest study yet to look at the relationship between coffee and health.
We found that the coffee drinkers, they had a modestly lower risk of death than the non-drinkers.
Those who drank at least 2 cups a day were about 10% less likely to die during the 13 years of the study. But you don't necessarily need to be a heavy coffee drinker. The benefits appear to kick in.
Starting with those drinking a cup a day or more.
And the more you drink, he says, the better. Now, the study doesn't prove coffee can make people live longer, and even if it is good for you, scientists have no idea why. It's not caffeine. Decaf seems to be just as good. But Friedman says there are lots of other possibilities.
There's many different compounds in coffee. It's estimated 1,000 or more than 1,000 different compounds, and each one of those might affect health in different ways.
Until scientists do more investigation, Friedman doesn't recommend anyone start drinking coffee or drink more coffee. But at the very least, the new findings reassure coffee lovers that they aren't hurting themselves by indulging in a couple of cappuccinos or lattes every day. Rob Stein, NPR News.
This week we're examining the stories of people who live near natural gas wells and are getting sick. We heard stories yesterday of people in Pennsylvania and Colorado. But it takes more than one person's story to make the connection between pollution and illness. Scientists say they want to study detailed information on a large group of people over a long period of time. And there is an effort to do that in the mountains of northern Pennsylvania. NPR's John Hamilton reports.
Energy companies have drilled about 5,000 gas wells in Pennsylvania's Marcellus Shale, and they plan to drill thousands more. So northern Pennsylvania is a pretty good place to ask whether all that drilling is affecting people's health. But researchers say there's another compelling reason to do a study here. It's a database of electronic health records on hundreds of thousands of people who live near the Marcellus Shale. Without records like this, it would be almost impossible to figure out whether drilling is affecting public health.
So here I'm bringing a patient up.
Dr. Paul Simonelli says those records mean that all kinds of information is just a few keystrokes away.
And what is immediately available here is all the office visits this particular patient has had in our system. This patient's been seen in our system well over a dozen times, and this dates back to 2001.
The database is one of just a handful in the nation that are so large and comprehensive. It belongs to the Geisinger Health System, which includes doctors, hospitals, and health insurance plans. Geisinger helps provide care for more than 2 million Pennsylvanians. Simonelli is the director of thoracic medicine at the system's gleaming headquarters in Danville. He says eventually, researchers hope to use the database to see whether there's a link between gas drilling and a wide range of diseases, such as cancer and diabetes. But they plan to start by focusing on just one health problem, asthma.
This is our pulmonary function lab. So if people were to come in to get pulmonary function testing, this is where they'd be, down this corridor.
Simonelli says people with asthma and other lung problems are very sensitive to some of the air pollutants that come from natural gas production. He says you can actually measure the effect these pollutants have on an asthma patient's lungs.
I want you to put the mouthpiece in your mouth, between your teeth, lips tight. I'm going to put nose clips on your nose so the air doesn't escape through there.
A technician named Mary Ellen Norquist shows how.
And then deep breath in. Keep going, keep pushing, push, 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 keep pushing, keep pushing. Couple more seconds.
Simonelli says the results of tests like this one all end up in the system's database. And that sort of information should make it possible to study the health effects of one pollutant that often forms near gas operations. It's ground-level ozone, or smog. Simonelli says when ozone levels rise, asthma patients start looking for help.
The first line of therapy are primary care physicians, and clearly they'll start seeing more business. We see it in the specialty clinics such as my own, where we'll be messaged by lots of patients that I'm getting worse, what should I do? People come in the emergency rooms.
About 6% of people in the U.S. have asthma. That means Geisinger has records on tens of thousands of asthma patients. And Simonelli says most of these patients live in rural areas where ozone wasn't a problem before gas drilling.
So we're talking about an enormous number of people who are potentially at risk to have their conditions worsened by these exposures.
The Geisinger database should be able to reveal any change because its records go back more than a decade. One scientist who believes in the Geisinger effort is Brian Schwartz, an environmental epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. He's working with Geisinger on the project. Schwartz says the system's information is so detailed that it's possible to gather information about specific groups of asthma patients, say those who live within a mile of a gas well.
How much medications they're using? Are they being admitted to the hospital? Are they requiring emergency department visits? Are they using more inhalers?
Schwartz says Geisinger is in a unique position to measure the effects of a huge natural experiment. That's because in Pennsylvania, large-scale drilling came relatively recently. In places like Texas, most wells were already operating by the time researchers started looking into health effects. And Schwartz says other places don't have Geisinger's trove of electronic health records that go back long before the gas boom started.
Because we have 10 years of health data, but the drilling has mainly been for the past 5 years, we have a period with information on asthma patients and controls before drilling, a period after drilling. And so I think it's a very powerful design that can answer a number of questions right now.
There's one big hitch, though. The asthma study alone is likely to cost nearly $1 million, and no one has offered to pay for it yet. Even so, Schwartz is optimistic. One reason is that the research has strong support at Geisinger, from the CEO on down. David Carey, who directs the system's Weiss Center for Research, says there's a good reason.
If you look at the map, the geographic footprint of our patient catchment area, this is literally going on in our backyard.
So Carey and other Geisinger officials have been promoting the study to scientists and funding agencies. And Carey says the response has been positive, in part because the health system is seen as a neutral party in the national debate about fracking and shale gas production.
We're not out to get anybody. We just want to let the facts lead us wherever they will. So if we do find that there are environmental exposures that are harming people's health, we'll say it. If we find evidence that there's nothing to worry about, we'll say that too.
Carey hopes to have an answer before a lot more drilling takes place in the Marcellus Shale. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Our series continues this afternoon, All Things Considered, with the story of a Texas town at the center of the fracking boom. Allie Raceman of Needham, Massachusetts, started gymnastics like a lot of other kids, in a toddler class, tumbling, making moves on a long spring track, a little like a trampoline. Today, at 17 years old, she is considered one of the best tumblers in the world and well on track to make the 2012 U.S. Olympic gymnastics team. From WBUR in Boston, Monica Brady-Meyerhoff reports.
As a gymnast, Allie Raceman sets herself apart with her power moves. Here she is at the 2012 American Cup, which was broadcast on NBC.
Unreal.
And she's capable of some unbelievable tumbling passes that I'm sure before she's performed this one, most people in the world would have said that this pass is not possible.
Raceman runs into a series of aerial somersaults that ends with a punch layout, which means she flips over, fully extended, like she's a pancake being flipped. It's almost like she's floating. If she nails it at the Olympic trials at the end of June, she'll have a very good chance of taking one of the 5 spots on the women's U.S. gymnastics team.
I'm excited and I'm anxious and I'm just kind of ready for it to happen. I feel like I've been waiting my whole life for it, so I just kind of want it to come now.
Her mother, Lynn Raceman, says as the oldest of 4 children, Allie has drive and determination in everything she does.
Gymnastics has really taken a priority in her life for a really long time, and that comes from her, because if it didn't, I think she would have quit a long time ago.
Raceman was only 2 in 1996 when the U.S. women's gymnastics team last took the gold. When Raceman set her sights on the Olympics, her mother found an old VCR tape of that golden team and gave it to her.
I would replay it like day after day after day, and I was literally obsessed with it. I could memorize all the scores and tell you like who is going next and all that stuff, and I was so inspired by it.
Until last year, Raceman went to Needham High School and maintained a rigorous training schedule. Now she's completing her senior year online. Most days she spends 7 hours at the gym. She says the key to tumbling is conditioning and not just lifting weights.
Actually, I have to climb the rope without legs with 10-pound weights on. It's very, very hard.
That's why your upper body looks so strong.
Yeah, I'm really strong. I mean, I look really strong, definitely compared to, like, normal girls. But I'm proud of it, I guess, because it's a lot of hard work to get that, and it doesn't just come overnight.
Raceman is an all-around gymnast, which means she competes on the floor, bars, vault, and balance beam.
Okay, but the takeoff, where is the takeoff?
At a gym in a suburb of Boston, Raceman practices her dismount from the balance beam. Coach Mihai Brestian stands a good distance away, quietly giving pointers.
Okay, this was a good one. Okay, stay with this one. That's it.
Brestian, who's Romanian, says Raceman is Olympic caliber because she's self-critical.
You know, to be successful, you cannot be all the time pleased with yourself. You need to be critical, because if on the day you think, oh, I am good enough, tomorrow it's somebody else better than you.
Raceman doesn't want anyone to be better than her. She wants a gold medal. But like any teenager, she's not entirely focused on the gold. She's also thinking about prom.
My prom dress is brown, and it's really different because most people don't wear brown to prom, but I'm excited. And
Allie Raceman says she wants to eventually go to college and study fashion, but right now she's focused on sticking a spot on the U.S. Olympic gymnastics team.
So I'm really excited to wear it, and a lot of people are going with the simple look this year.
For NPR News, I'm Monica Brady-Myrov in Boston.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. The United States is in the middle of a natural gas boom. These days, a community can find itself not simply with one or two new wells, but suddenly surrounded by them. And that has some locals worried. Their biggest concern is that the chemicals used in gas production are causing everything from nosebleeds to cancer. But scientists see it differently. They say the evidence of harm just isn't convincing. To find out why there's such a disconnect, NPR's John Hamilton visited the small town of Dish, Texas.
Look at a satellite image of Dish, and you'll see an odd patchwork. There are ranch-style homes and green pastures, but there are also rectangles of gray-blue gravel. Zoom in a bit, and you can see they're filled with gas wells, compressors, storage tanks, and metering stations. Bill Zisko is the mayor of Dish, and he has a message for anyone who expects to see gas drilling in their town.
Run! Run as fast as you can. Grab up your family and your belongings and get out.
Zisko says he can't leave. He owns too much property here that no one wants to buy. So he took over as mayor last year after the previous mayor and his family left to get away from the drilling. Zisko's an imposing guy. Black boots, black sports coat, aviator sunglasses. He shows me around town. About 225 people live here among the gas wells. In some areas, there's the sulfurous odor of escaping gas. In others, you can feel the rumble of compressor engines big enough to power a locomotive. Zisko says things were very different when he moved here in 1987.
This place was absolutely beautiful. It was serene. It was very quiet, very clean. I raised five children here.
Then, around 2005, two things happened to the town, which was named Clark at the time. First, Clark became Dish as part of a deal to get free satellite TV service from the Dish network. Second, energy companies arrived and began drilling lots of gas wells. The wells were made possible by a technique known as hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, which released natural gas trapped in the hard shale a mile underground.
We're going to take a left on this dirt road right here in front of the truck.
Zisko has brought me to the biggest thing in Dish.
We can just pull right up to the gate here.
It's a swath of gas wells and heavy equipment that stretches for a quarter mile. Zisko says emissions from this site aren't safe to breathe.
It's just a who's who toxic chemical mix. Pretty much all of those items that you get from petroleum products are spewing into the air in this area.
A few years ago, the town spent $15,000 on an air quality study. It found elevated levels of several chemicals, including benzene. But since then, energy companies have fixed some problems, and the state installed a device that constantly sniffs the air for pollution. It shows levels are generally within government limits. And when state health officials came to check for toxins in residents' blood and urine, they found no cause for concern. Even so, Cisco firmly believes that people in Dish have been hurt.
There's not a lot of residents right around this facility, but within a quarter of a mile, half a mile of this facility, there's been six people die of cancer here. And so do I think that this is a concern? Yes, I do.
Cisco is pretty convincing. And even scientists who are skeptical about his claims say they understand why he's concerned. But they also say the scientific evidence that gas production around Dish has made anyone sick is pretty weak. To understand why, I go see Brian Schwartz, an environmental epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. I ask him what would it take to figure out whether there really is a link between gas operations around Dish and those people with cancer.
My answer to that would be you can't. You can't study that right now because it takes about 20 years, let's say, for solid tumors to develop after exposure to a chemical. So if the drilling has happened in the last 5 years, I cannot answer the cancer question right now.
Schwartz says even if more time had passed, a half dozen cancer cases probably wouldn't mean much, unless they were all the same type of cancer.
Cancer is not one disease. Cancer is 100 different diseases. So if that person has leukemia, that person has lung cancer, and that person has ovarian cancer, it's not a cancer cluster. Those three cancers all have very, very different causes.
Health officials in the U.S. check out more than 1,000 suspected cancer clusters each year. They almost never find anything. Of course, cancer is just one of the concerns in Dish. The previous mayor, the guy who left town last year, is Calvin Tillman. Tillman says he got worried when his two sons began getting nosebleeds. Then one night, he says, his younger son had a nosebleed that got really bad.
Our house literally looked like a murder scene. There was blood down the wall in the hallway. And I got up the next morning to go to work, and my wife said, "That is it." And at that moment, we decided we've got to move out of here.
Tillman moved his family off the shale to a town called Aubrey. He says back when he was still mayor, he realized that scientists wouldn't pay attention to just one story like his. So he had residents fill out a health survey.
Do you have itchy eyes, bloody nose, runny nose, scratchy throat, things like that? And it came back that about half the people that were polled had a symptom that could be related to one of the chemicals that we found in our air study.
But scientists say the mere presence of a chemical isn't enough. You have to know how much people were exposed to and for how long. Tom LaPointe is a toxicologist at the University of North Texas in Denton, about 15 miles east of Dish. He's also part of a task force looking at the impact of fracking. LaPointe says modern testing equipment can detect chemicals at levels far, far below those known to hurt anyone.
I've had people get quite upset saying, well, we can measure benzene. Well, yes, we measured benzene, but the concentrations are below the effect level. And that means something. That really does.
LaPointe says even if tests do find enough of a chemical to cause health effects, there's another scientific hurdle. Researchers need to know whether the pollutant is coming from local gas operations or some other source, like cars and trucks. LaPointe says that's hard to figure out in a place like Dish because it gets so much of its air pollution from the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
So ironically, even though we're not by any means the largest county in the Metroplex, we have the worst air quality because the general winds bring it up from Dallas and Fort Worth over Denton County,
where it mixes with the pollutants from gas production. So you've got two mayors from one small town making some big claims. And you've got scientists who say those claims aren't backed by solid evidence. But are the mayors wrong to say that gas production is a hazard? Brian Schwartz, the epidemiologist from Johns Hopkins, says no one knows. And he says that's a big problem.
When these areas are developed, thousands to tens of thousands of wells are drilled and fracked. So the magnitude is huge. And frankly, the development is way out ahead of public health evaluations of any kind to date.
Schwartz says that's not fair to Dish or any other place where people are worried about the health effects of drilling and fracking. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Something tells me you've heard this before. It's not whether you win or lose, it's how you play the game. Well, as Frank DeFord points out, nobody said anything about a tie.
Politicians love to boast about American exceptionalism, how special we are from all the merely ordinary, everyday, run-of-the-mill countries around the globe. I would say that what sets us apart, more all the time, is that we Americans don't like ties. I don't mean four-in hands or bow ties, but the ties in games. The ones that somebody once said are like kissing your sister. Boy, do I agree. And I never even had a sister. Nothing about me is more American than that I don't like ties. Lots of times, in other English-speaking countries, a tie is called a draw. Well, partner, in these United States, when we say draw, you don't mean a namby-pamby, even Steven. We mean John Wayne a-reaching for his six-shooter. Now, that's the American way to draw, a standing our ground. Okay, we used to countenance tie games. Look back through the records and you'll see that in the olden days, all football teams played lots of ties. For the best teams, the expression even went unbeaten and untied. Nobody says that anymore. You're either beat or you're doing the beating. No Mr. In-between. College football changed the rules in 1996, so two teams keep playing until somebody wins. The NFL is still a little wimpish. There have been two NFL ties in the 21st century, too many in the minds of good red-blooded Americans like me. Ice hockey was a tie city. I blame that on the Canadians, who are so nice. But now in hockey, we got shootouts. That's the all-American way. There hasn't been a tie in the NHL since April 4th, 2004, and there never will be another. The worst thing that happened to baseball since steroids was when they ran out of pitchers at the 2002 All-Star Game, and it was called a draw, a date that will live in stupidity. Do you know they have ties in Japanese baseball? Now, that just flat-out takes the national out of pastime. But, of course, the rest of the world loves soccer, and it is reliably calculated that 30% of all soccer games end tied, draw, deadlock, nil-nil. How does the rest of the unexceptional world tolerate this? It's exactly this kind of thinking, I believe, which is why they can't fix the bloody euro. The dollar is a winner. The euro is a tie. Get off the dime, Europe, and play to win. In this country, the teams in Major League Soccer play a 34-game schedule. They averaged 11 ties a team. Chicago had 16 ties out of 34. Couldn't they at least get rid of ties in American soccer? A tie has no place in sports. It's like not finding out who is the who in whodunit.
Commentator Frank DeFord, his latest book is a memoir, Overtime, My Life as a Sports Writer. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.